House Committee on Revenue for February 22nd, 2018 will come to order. Colleagues, I'm going to start at the bottom of the agenda today and open the public hearing on House or Senate Bill 1555. Who's on that one? Mazin, is that yours?
Yes, sir.
Come and tell us about the bill.
Chairs, members of the committee, this bill, Senate Bill 1555, comes to you from the Senate side. This is probably the first Senate bill that we get, but this primarily deals with the issue of distribution of marijuana revenues. This bill primarily opens up the use of the percentage that is allocated to the mental health program to be used for purposes that are slightly different in what's specified in law. And it opens it up to be used in the mental health treatment for alcohol and drug abuse prevention and early intervention treatment. So that is also sunsetted in a few years down the line. So it brings it back to what it is. Just to give you an idea of how the these distributions that you have in law today, if you if you're looking at the bill, you have the in your second page, you have all the way distribution from line 13 all the way down to 18. It basically specifies how these revenues are done, which is 10% to cities, 10% to counties under different formulas, and then 40% to schools, and 15% to state police, and then you know, 5% to prevention, and then the 20% that this bill deals with. This is on line 15 of your second page.
Thank you. Welcome to the House Committee on Revenue, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner here with State Senate District 17. I appreciate your hearing, Senate Bill 1555A. As your excellent staff pointed out, when we passed all the legislation around cannabis, we designated where all the tax revenues would go. And despite the fact that the fund that this goes into says that it's for mental health and addiction treatment, in fact, the actual statutory language does not allow it to be used for anything other than addiction treatment. During the 2017-19 biennium, Representative Rayfield and I, as co-chairs of the Human Services Budget Committee, designated $20 million of marijuana revenue to go for community mental health and addiction treatment. However, it turns out we can only use $4 million of that unless we pass Senate Bill 1555A. If we do not pass Senate Bill 1555A, we will have to make up the $16 million in money for community mental health through general fund, meaning that we can't allocate it for something else. This bill is short-term. It is only for this biennium. We plan a longer-term fix that we will work on between now and the 2019 session and pass a different piece of legislation to ensure that funding is going to all the right places. So this is a absolutely perfect short session bill. It's about budget and it's a technical fix. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions for the good senator? Do we have a witness list?
No, sure. We don't.
Nobody else has signed up?
Can I just ask you?
No one else has signed up.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please. Representative Buehler, please.
I'm a little slow on the uptake today. Apologies. Could you just tell me one more time why we need this?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler. As your staff pointed out, the cannabis tax revenues have very specific designations in statute. 20% of those revenues go towards a fund that has a title that's something like mental health and substance abuse prevention and treatment, right?
Right.
Unfortunately, although that title of that fund implies that those funds can be used for mental health treatment other than substance abuse and treatment and prevention, in fact, the statute underlying that fund currently only allows those funds to be used for addiction treatment and prevention. So my co-chair and I, thinking that that fund was actually going to allow us to put more money into community mental health, designated $20 million of that cannabis revenue to that fund. And in fact, we later discovered that we were unable to send those monies where we wanted to send them because of the statute that underlies the name of that fund. So this is a technical fix for this biennium to allow us to continue to appropriate those revenues from cannabis taxes towards community mental health, and then we will work on a better solution in the interim prior to getting the 2019-21 budgets up and running. Does that clarify it, Representative?
Thank you.
I think it was as clear as the first time, but I just didn't.
Representative Rushkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator. Just so I'm clear, it's $4 million is what we can allocate now, and by making this change, it would go to $20 million. So it's a difference of $16 million just for this biennium. Sunsets at the end of, July 1st, 2019 or something like that? Okay. All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rushkey, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? I'm quickly looking at this statute that you refer to in the bill, ORS 430.380, and it looks like in that statute 40% of the money goes to mental health and addiction or mental health, alcoholism, and drug services account appropriated to the counties, and they're to use the money to operate and maintenance alcohol and drug abuse prevention, early intervention, treatment services. Then 40% goes to Oregon Health Authority to be used for the state matching funds to counties for alcohol and drug abuse treatment, early intervention, and treatment services. And 20%, which I guess is the rest, is appropriated to the Oregon Health Authority to be used for alcoholism and alcohol and drug abuse prevention, early intervention, and treatment services for inmates at correctional and penal institutions and for parolees therefrom and for probationers, as provided in pursuant to the rules of the authority. Okay. The reason I recite all of that is that I'm probably just as slow as Representative Buehler claims to be today. I'm not seeing how this improves things. Could you explain that again so we can try to get our heads around it? And it may simply be that we're having trouble understanding what the problem in the original bill is.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, this is one of those problems where we're taking percentages of percentages, and so it gets really confusing really quickly. And I freely admit that. And we had to go back and parse through it in some detail. But the long and the short of it is, as you detailed it out, you'll note that all of those allocations were for substance abuse treatment.
Correct.
Right? Or prevention, which is a great cause for it. However, we know that a significant percentage of the time, substance misuse disorders co-occur with other underlying mental health issues. And if we can address those issues early through community mental health programs, then we can often prevent substance use disorders, which is, in fact, in line with the intent of the original allocation of the funds. And we have worked closely with the counties and the county mental health programs. They are supportive, or at least neutral, on this because we understand this is a short-term fix. But now, in addition to directly going towards substance use disorder prevention and treatment, it can also go towards community mental health programs that will help prevent those in the first place. So it will be used for prevention, just in a slightly different way.
Representative Buehler.
Just a clarification. It does say 20% of the monies in the account must be used solely for mental health treatment or for alcohol and drug abuse prevention.
Yes, but the 20% that we're talking about the math gets a little bit wonky here, Representative, and I probably would have to phone a friend to get you the exact details of the math. But the long and the short of it is, I mean, I hate to say this, but we can get you the detailed math, or some of it's probably in OLIS from the testimony on the Senate side in Senate Human Services Committee. But the long and the short of it is, if we pass this bill, the money goes where it needs to go for this biennium, and if we don't, to make the money go where it needs to go, we appropriate $16 million in general fund, and we don't actually increase the amount going to substance use disorders. It goes to other places. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be vague or evasive here, Representative.
Mazin may help us a little on that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So,
thank you.
Yeah.
The small difference that seems to be the issue of the bill is when you look at line 15 in the bill, it says that 20%, and it goes to say solely for the purpose of, and it specifies that solely for the purpose of as described in ORS 433.380, which the appropriation that the Committee on Health Services did somehow is not exactly in 43.380. So the solution would have been both either to include that or to allow for this year to take out that specific reference to law, which is the ORS 43380, and just make it more generic as a mental health treatment for alcohol and drug prevention. And as you see, the way legislative council does is after they have that in statute, then goes back in section 2 in line 32 and 30 and 31 and 32 and amends again that statute and puts back ORS 430.380 to be the only sole use for this money. That's, I think, how the mechanics of it work.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm still having a difficulty understanding how this helps, and maybe I misunderstand what you're trying to accomplish. If I read this statute that you refer to, 430.380, it looks to me as though all the money has to be spent in this account, which is called the Mental Health, Alcoholism, and Drug Services account, has to be spent on the operation, establishment, operation, and maintenance of drug and alcohol abuse prevention, early intervention, and treatment services. And as I look through the various sections of that statute, they all refer, as I see it, alcohol and drug abuse prevention, early intervention, and treatment services. There's no reference that I can see to mental health. What am I missing?
In the current statute, Representative?
In the statute that you want to use as the definition.
Right, that's the problem.
Yes.
That's exactly the problem we're trying to fix. Because it's all very specific to alcohol and substance use, as opposed to other mental health problems, we can't use the money that we allocated toward community mental health for community mental health purposes, which, as I outlined, can be very important in preventing substance use disorders in the first place. So we need to fix this so that we can amend in other mental health purposes or adjust which statute we refer to so that we can use those funds to fund important community mental health programs for this biennium and not have to pull money out of community mental health or find $16 million in general fund. We're kind of awash in cannabis tax revenue, Representative, and it would be appropriate from many people's perspective to use some of this for other mental health programs in addition to substance use issues.
Remember, I don't have the benefit of having served on the Joint Committee.
I understand.
Joint Committee. So, but
I didn't either, but
I do
budgets.
All right. But look, I think what you've just said is you want to have money available for community mental health.
Yes.
Okay. I think what the statute says is that the money has to be spent on these other things.
That's correct, and that's what we're trying to fix.
But the statute you're amending into this bill requires that the money not be spent on mental health, that it be spent instead on these other things. What am I missing here?
We're making an exception to the statute just for this biennium, Representative. That's what we're trying to do. Just for this biennium, we're making an exception so that we can use it for other mental health programs just for this biennium, and then we'll come up with a better fix.
All right. Is that exception in this bill, or is it somewhere else?
It's in. It should be in.
Chair Bernard, I would offer.
Please.
It's line 17.
Thank you. I don't have the bill in front of me. Yeah, I didn't realize when we were. I mean, the schedule's got a little complicated.
It converts the current language in 43380. Which is says mental health alcoholism to
I'm looking line at 17, the wrong section.
Which is mental health treatment for alcohol and drug abuse. That allows you to spend it for mental health treatment. Is that correct?
That's correct. Thank you, Representative Barnhart, Representative Finley. That's what we're talking about.
All right.
Thank you. I don't have the bill in front of me because I thought this was coming later in your hearing.
All right. No, I really appreciate Representative Finley's intervention.
As do I.
Because as I look at the bill now, what's obvious is that what is obvious, given your comment, is that the first part of the bill sets up this new idea, the mental health treatment for alcoholism and drug abuse prevention, early intervention and treatment, which is exactly what you said you want on line 17 and 18. And the second part of the bill on the next page on line 31 through 33 restores the language after the sunset.
That's correct.
Thank you. That makes it all clear. I hope it makes it clear, Representative Buehler, to you as well.
Okay, that helps.
Now I understand. The bill actually does both the fix and the restoration of the unfix.
That's correct.
All right.
That's correct. That and really then we will to. Be working on new legislation during the interim between now and the 2019 session to create more appropriate language for the underlying current statute, unamended, that will be back unamended after July 1st of 2019.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Finley, very much for being my lifeline.
Representative Finley, you have a great future in reading bills, because this is one of those things that we do regularly here, and I just missed it.
It was all in that one line, sir.
It's in that one line. You're exactly right. All right. Now that we've finally gotten the chair educated, are there other questions, comments?
Yeah, I just have
Representative Buehler, yep. Please.
Thank you, Chair. Senator, I agree we're not spending enough on community mental health, but I have a concern specifically from Deschutes County that we're also not spending enough on enforcement purposes with regards to marijuana grow operations, and many counties have expressed this concern that we've created this regulatory structure and the counties do not have enough resources to deal with the regulatory structure we've set up. So why aren't we addressing that issue? And that's also been called out by Secretary of State in his recent communications about this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler, I appreciate your concern, and I share some of them, but it's really not within the purview of this bill, and it's also not within the purview of my knowledge subset, given the committee that I chair. So I absolutely concur that we have more to do with cannabis regulation, and I would be eager to improve our tracking system and do all those other things, but it's really not the subject or relevant to the content of this bill with respect, sir. I can't help you with that.
I think it is very relevant. We're allocating marijuana tax revenue, and this in enforcement is very much part of this allocation, just like mental health is. So why isn't it relevant?
Well, could I just simply say, it looks to me like the purpose of this bill is to deal with the one particular technical fix, and it doesn't deal with that other topic. I agree with you that the other topic makes a lot of sense to discuss, but this bill doesn't do that.
Yeah, not so much. Is this really a technical fix, or is this just adding another source of allocation of the dollars?
Mr. Chair, this is not changing the allocations of the marijuana revenue. Marijuana revenue allocations came in Measure 91. This is exactly how it is. The only difference that we've done since then is move the 40%. That goes to the common school fund and made it to state school fund, because the measure at that time probably meant it to be schools rather than the common school fund, which is the endowment type of. Other than that, all these distributions do copy exactly what came in Measure 91 at the time of legalization. I don't think the Joint Committee took any liberty in changing any of that. The only thing that was changed is how these whether they're distributed immediately or how they work through the budget process. The legislature, however, could, if it chooses to, take money off the top of the collection and send that money to a special enforcement function that is aside from these distributions. But these distributions kind of kept the spirit of the law as amendment of the Measure 91 that was carried by the voters in them.
Mr. Chair Mazin, thank you very much. That's, the money that's going is what was originally allocated. We're only changing the exact purpose for which the monies that would have been allocated in this direction anyway can be used. That's all we're doing. We're not allocating additional monies.
I get that, but
Representative Bueller?
The exact purpose was monies in the mental health, alcoholism, and drug services account.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, that's correct. And that money will still stay in that account. But unfortunately, despite the title of that account, the underlying statute prohibits it from being used for other mental health issues than substance use disorders. Mm-hmm. So all we're trying to do is for this biennium to allow us to use the funds that would otherwise have been allocated to that account for additional community mental health purposes. And it's a short-term fix.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much for bringing it. Thank you, Representative Finley, for getting us back on track. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 1555, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1555. We're closing and opening Senate Bill 1529 for a public hearing. While we've got everybody here, okay.
Hey, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We have Senate Bill 1529. So the bill is updating Oregon's connection to Internal Revenue Code. Many of the provisions, again, as just in some way lines up, or some of the provisions line up with what the committee heard on House Bill 4080, the introduced version. But the connection date for much of the underlying bill has to do with moving that fixed date and time from December 31st, 2016 up to December 31st, 2017. So most of the underlying changes, and I do have a document up in OLUS that breaks down the measure into sections, is moving those individual specific connection dates up 1 year.
Can I ask one quick question?
Representative Smith.
I actually believe I know the answer to this, but I think it'd be helpful for everyone to understand. What if we don't make that modification to the connection date? Share with the public what that means.
Yes, Representative, if we don't make that change, then the change or the connection date is just a point in time, so we would just stay connected to whatever the structure was in the Internal Revenue Code as of December 31st, 2016. So if there have been changes, in a lot of cases these may be definitional changes that we're tying to at the federal level, but Oregon wouldn't capture any of those changes at the federal level. So you certainly can stay at that point in time, and then it just wouldn't capture any of those changes or updates made at the federal level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think it's important for everyone to understand that.
Thank you.
And just as a reminder, this is not Oregon's rolling reconnect, which is the definition of tax plan comes, which grabs most of the changes as in regards to where Oregon starts for it, for computing taxes, personal income tax, corporate income tax. So these are the point in time connections. And that's, I'm referencing, the Senate Bill 1529A section contents, which is in OLUS under the meeting materials. But so the first 27 sections of the bill are related to those point in time connections. And again, there's some description of what those connections are. In many cases, those are definitional connections and such. Sections, beginning with sections 28 through 37, have to do with repatriation. And this is something that Chris has discussed with the committee before, and the changes that happened at the federal level and the repatriation of those dollars. So that's in sections 28 and 29. Sections 30 and 31 then set up a mechanism to transfer those repatriated dollars to the rainy day fund transfer. And I will note as well, there are two amendments, and I'll get to those in just a second as well. And then 32 through sections 32 through 36 have to do with tax credit for taxes paid from the tax saving legislation. So there's a tax credit that's being put in place that has to do with corporations that are, have paid taxes on Oregon's tax saving law that are now being subject to repatriation. And then section 37 is just the adjournment sine die language. So the two amendments that are in OLS, we have the dash A8 and the A9. the A8, what it's doing is essentially getting rid of sections 28 through 36. So the repatriation, the rainy day fund transfer, and the tax credit related to tax saving, that language would be eliminated. So you'd just be left with the underlying point in time connection parts of the bill. And then the A9 is making a technical change to the repatriation language of where Oregon is connecting to. So that's in an effort just to make sure that however the IRS ends up writing the actual language in the law, Oregon will connect to the correct definition, essentially, to grab those repatriated dollars. It then also would redirect the funds. Instead of going to the rainy day, they'd go into the public employees retirement fund. And then it would also, the last change in the A9 is eliminating the repeal of the tax haven law. So there is still the tax haven credit, but then going forward under the Senate Bill 1529, the A version, it would repeal the tax haven law here in Oregon. That would stay in place with the dash A9 going forward. That is the summary of what we have with the two amendments.
All right, great. We have five people who have asked to be heard on this short little bill. So we'll just go down the list. Charles Fisher, Daniel Hauser, Marsha Kelly, first panel.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Charlie Fisher. I'm the director of OSPIRG, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We're a citizen-based consumer advocacy organization. And here, just to testify to one portion of this bill, which is the repeal of the tax havens law, Section 35, which we strongly oppose this provision and urge you to do everything you can to take it out before final passage of the legislation. So a little bit of background, you'll recall that in 2013, the legislature actually unanimously adopted this tax havens law, which identified an extensive list of tax haven countries and required Oregon corporate tax filers to add income from any subsidiaries in those countries to their Oregon taxable income. It was based on a 2003 Montana law that was successful. And a March 2017 report from LRO estimated that it kept more than $20 million in Oregon during the 2014 tax year rather than being parked in offshore tax haven countries like the Cayman Islands. Now, I think presumably the reasoning behind this repeal is that federal tax reform will prevent further tax haven abuse. But in our view, we think this analysis is, one, premature, and two, likely incorrect. So to the first point, we think that repealing this tax haven law just assumes outcomes that are not clearly understood yet. The tax reform law signed into law just 2 months ago is an incredibly complex and hard to understand piece of legislation. And there's still significant questions among tax policy experts as to the real world implications of tax reform on a multitude of issues, not just tax havens. And so repealing Oregon's tax haven law, which has a proven track record of success, is premature. So we recommend that the legislature leave Oregon's tax haven law in place and direct the Department of Revenue to take the time necessary to really study the interaction between federal tax reform and Oregon's tax havens law so we don't make any premature fixes that leave us with less revenue than we did before. The second part is a lot of analysis is that some of the provisions in tax reform would actually create even more incentive for multinational companies to use complex schemes to move profits offshore. The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy says that one significant part of tax reform, switching to a territorial tax system, would, quote, increase the already substantial benefits American corporations obtain when they use accounting gimmicks to make their profits appear to be earned in a foreign country that has no corporate income tax or has one that is extremely low or easy to avoid. Further, Kimberly Clausing, an economics professor from Reed College, who actually specializes in multinational company taxation, says, quote, "The new system provides an explicit permanent preference for earning income in low tax countries rather than the United States." So from our view, not only is it too early to really tell what the implications are going to be on tax haven abuse from tax reform, but some of the preliminary analysis is that it will not solve the problem and it may make it worse. And if we repeal Oregon's tax havens law now, we potentially are losing that revenue that should be taxed in Oregon without any other recourse. So we strongly urge you to remove the Section 35 from this bill and maintain Oregon's tax havens law. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Hauser, and I am the Tax Policy Analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I think that this testimony was drafted prior to the Dash A9s being posted, and I believe that that amendment does a good job of capturing much of what I want to address. So I'll kind of give you the simple point of adopt the Dash A9 amendments, get rid of this repeal of Oregon's tax haven law, which is an incredibly effective tool for protecting some of Oregon taxpayers from this profit shifting that's going on by these multinational corporations out into these tax haven countries. And so I think that at a base level, incorporating the A9 amendments does a good job of preserving this protection for Oregonians. And the quirk with the deemed dividends, fixing that to me seems like a really easy and obvious tool or a tactic that we need to take as a state to ensure that we're not giving a tax cut to corporations simply for having kept money offshore. Now that the federal government's repatriating it, we're now going to turn around and give them a tax cut as a result of that. I think it makes clear sense that instead they should be paying more taxes on all of that taxable income they're bringing back into the U.S. And so I'd encourage you to adopt the Dash A9 amendments and simply make sure we are taxing that repatriated income and keeping Oregon's tax haven law in place. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Marsha Kelly, the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, and I guess I would just say ditto, ditto, ditto. Sometimes moving too fast creates situations that we would not like to see, and the loss of any revenue, as you just heard in a prior bill when we're talking about $16 million, the loss of any revenue affects the lives of all Oregonians. And so I would urge you to adopt the A9s and leave in place the tax haven law until we can really ascertain whether it can be manipulated to the benefit of multinationals rather than to the benefit of Oregonians who need resources for child welfare, for mental health, for education. Thank you.
Thank you. When you say it can be manipulated, I assume you're referring to GILTI, the federal version, as it were.
Yes, and you know, many of the multinationals have very creative and extensive tax departments,
right.
And so normally they can, there are other tax issues that you've been discussing in this building where it's easily manipulated as well. So it's just something that we should maybe hold off on and make sure that we don't throw out money that we could otherwise use for mental health, child welfare,
thank you,
and education.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know why the Senate included it in the bill?
You mean excluded it?
Or, well, they're sunsetting the law or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah.
I suspect, I don't know this, you may want to inquire over there, but I suspect that they believe that the safeguards in the federal law, which we refer to as GILTI, are sufficient. I think, if I understand the testimony correctly, it is that you're not so sure about that, and we ought to keep our suspenders while we add a belt.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Nose, I would Well, yes, is the short answer. The longer answer is prior Montana Department of Revenue head and multi-state tax commission director for a number of years, Dan Bucks submitted testimony that does a really good job of going into detail and really explaining why the federal provisions of GILTI, FDII, and BEAT are inadequate for protecting Oregon, and that our tax haven law we already have in place is already probably a better protection than these new provisions are. And so I think that one of the consequences of short session is that things are posted and happen quickly, and we were not able to, and that was my mistake, to properly push back in the Senate on this tax haven repeal. It was posted and passed very quickly, and so that was something that we should have done then. But we're really thankful that this body has two chambers, and we now have the opportunity to share with you all why this was a mistaken move by the Senate. Thank you.
Right. I think you're referring to the letter of February 22nd from Dan Bucks in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Correct.
That is, it is posted in OLIS, colleagues. So you can take a look at it. Other questions? Thank you so much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Bob Estabrook, Jody Weiser, please.
Jody Weiser, speaking for Tax Furnace, Oregon. We don't really know much about international taxation, so we asked the two people we know who do, Dan Bucks and Kimberly Klossing, and our testimony has their comments, each of them urging you to keep our tax haven law because businesses will probably keep putting money elsewhere rather than bringing it home. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Estabrook representing the 22,000 education workers represented by Oregon School Employees Association. I just wanted to very briefly say we agree with what's been said. It's important to address the dividend deduction. The bill already does that, and we would applaud the committee in adopting the A9 amendments to keep the tax haven law in place until we have more information to be able to move forward appropriately and ensure that we have a fair and adequate revenue system to support fair and adequate school funding.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? This is all we have for public testimony for today. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill, or sorry, Senate Bill. I'm still not dealing with Senate bills yet. Senate Bill 1529, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 4007. I'm going back to the top of the agenda. Who's on that? Is that yours? Okay. Tell us where we are and what we've got.
Okay, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4007, we do have the dash A12 amendment. So the A12 amendment, this bill was discussed, just as a reminder, this is the first-time home buyer savings account, as well as a change to the document recording fee. And the dash 12 came in right before the committee started. I think this was yesterday. But so what the A12 would do is extends for two additional years from what's in the introduced version or the A engrossed version for the first-time homebuyer savings account. Tax subtraction exclusion would go from January 1st, 2025 to January 1st, 2027. So it's 2 years additional to the sunset date. And then the document recording fee would go from $20 in an existing law to $60, which is down from $75 in the A engrossed version. So those are the two changes in the A12. As a reminder, this bill is requested to go to Ways and Means, which was added after the fact.
So we added the subsequent based on the obvious fact that it sets up an account, I think. Okay, what is your pleasure? Do you have your position on this one?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I think House Bill 4007 is a piece of legislation that we eventually will be able to reach consensus on, but I think there's additional conversations between Republican Leader McClain and Speaker Kotek on this issue. And so I know we're optimistic that we can find consensus, but I think we're still a day or two out on that.
Okay. Are you prepared to move it to Ways and Means?
As of right now, I haven't received direction to do that yet.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, but I'm optimistic we'll be able to reach consensus soon.
Representative Smith-Warner, do you have a...
Perhaps let's... Representative Kenny Geyer?
Did you want to be heard, Representative Kenny Geyer?
Yeah, a couple of us wanted to put something on the record.
Please come.
Technical amendments.
Please come and do that.
Oh, wait.
Yeah, and get it on the mic so we've got it in the minutes.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer, House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to put a couple of things on the record because I think it's important in front of your revenue committee to be able to say something about technical amendments that will be coming. I also was eager to have the opportunity to sit next to Sean Gillians here. We're not always on the same side, and I didn't get that opportunity yesterday, so I just was looking for an excuse to be up here with him to, again, express our support for 4007 and to encourage you. Oh, look, we're going to get it here.
Here's
on,
one for the record.
Just so we can prove it later.
So we, exactly. So the two of us.
It's been great working in this process.
It's been months and months, and I spent more of my time talking about the document recording fee part of the bill when I came before you a couple days ago, and I let Sean really handle the savings account because he's been working on this for months with his other Sean, and as I said at that time, I have been joined at the hip with them for months working on this. And so because it is a new account, we've been working through a lot of the details. And Deanna has been fantastic coming to us with, as she reads it, you know, each edition that has come out, okay, let's make sure this is clear. So we started with an LC drafter, Sean, and then we went to Robert, and then Robert was sick this week. We all sat down and went through kind of our last round of technical amendments. We agreed to them on Monday, but then he got sick, and so they just appeared, a dash 13, just arrived today, and we were sending it out to everyone. So our recommendation would be that you move the bill and let us adopt those in the Ways and Means. But because you're the Revenue Committee, I wanted to make sure that you knew the nature of them and had the opportunity to have your eagle eye resource here speak to it, because it is a new account and we have done a huge amount of due diligence to make sure that it's set up in a way that DOR can actually administer it. I'll just mention them briefly, then turn over to Sean and then let Deanna ask any questions. Basically, they had to do with at the end of, if an account holder wants to withdraw the funds and not use it for the purposes that the fund was set up to purchase a home, they would have to pay back the back taxes on that. And originally we had in the bill, and there had to be a penalty. At some point along the way, the penalty got dropped, and we want to put that back in because it is important to incentivize them to use the savings account for the purpose it was established. But it also, we had in the bill that we would exclude them from having to pay that penalty if they had a death or disability. Deanna brought up the point to us, how do you define disability? So that is part of the technical amendment. We had a question about whether you could front load it, in other words, put in $15,000, even though you're only allowed deduction on $5,000 a year, could you put in $15,000, roll that over? We talked that out. We got a lot of advice from Deanna and decided not to do that, so that's clarified in this. Grandfathering, we wanted to make sure that it was clear that accounts that that were in effect and had been established up until the sunset date 8 years forward could continue to move forward for their 10-year period and continue to be subject to that benefit of being able to deduct. So I think there was an of and a the kind of thing, but those are the main ones that I remember. So I wonder if you want to address any of those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Gillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Also wanted to stress that we do support the dash A12 amendments that you have before you now. And I think the chair did a good job sort of summarizing where we're at. We literally just got the language for the technical sort of amendments that we have there. We're comfortable moving forward and addressing those in Ways and Means. Happy, Mr. Chair, if you still have questions around the sideboards around the first-time homebuyer savings account, to address those as well.
And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I'm just here to answer technical questions. They did summarize all of the technical items that we pointed out, I believe.
Thank you.
And Deanna, if I could just ask for the record, I have asked a number of times, is this being done in a way that can be administered by Department of Revenue?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Kinnegar, yes, it is something the department can administer.
Representative Finley, please.
I have a question for, thank you, Chair. We had comments yesterday, and there was a comment made that will this program allow someone to buy a house from their family and have them carry the contract, or from another individual and have them carry the contract? Mm-hmm. And not receive outside financing for it. I couldn't really see that it excluded or included that. I thought it was an interesting point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Finley, we don't distinguish how you have to make the purchase of the home in this particular circumstance. While it's called a down payment assistance program, it's actually been raised to us. Manufactured homes, newer manufactured homes are included there. You might have the situation where you actually raise enough money that you purchase the entire manufactured home with what you've saved in there rather than having non-traditional financing.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Other questions, comments? Let me ask you, we don't have the 13. Is that not, is still being worked at LC? Why is it that we don't have it?
Mr. Chair, there's now a 15, which literally just came out about 2 minutes ago, and we've all been sort of looking through it. You do have the A-12s.
Yes.
You have all the paperwork on the A-12s.
Correct.
And I think what our intent would be is if you all feel inclined to move it to Ways and Means, in the Ways and Means process, we'll work on the 15s and adopting them there.
We have the paperwork for the A-12, so that means we'd need to adopt the A-12 and then send it to Ways and Means. Let me ask, does the 15 include the change in the amount of the document recording fee, or is it assumed that the A-12 is necessary to accomplish that goal?
Right.
That's correct, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. All right, that helps me figure out
from the 6-year sunset to the 8.
Right, which is also in the A-12.
That's correct.
That we have. All right.
Only thing that would be in front of the Ways and Means would be these technical fixes, and that's why we want to make sure that you, as the Revenue Committee,
right,
have Deanna here to say she's worked on them.
I have to tell you that I appreciate what you've done, because most of the things you've described are things that actually do have to do with the savings fund, and you're following the instructions that you and I discussed a year ago on making it tight.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may, I wanted to clarify on the grandfathering component what that means, because you'll see in one of the amendments, once we see them, the date, it's kind of an interesting way to structure it, but the accounts can be opened for 8 years.
Yes.
And if they open the account like the day before the end of the period, then that's a qualifying account. So the subtractions and the exemptions from taxation continue for 10 years beyond that date. So you'll see, I believe in the bill, correct me if I'm wrong, Sean, it takes us out to 2037 for those tax benefits for those folks.
Right.
So that's what the grandfathering means. Yeah. It's a little different than normal, but it's kind of like there's a couple other ones that, like, the rural medical credit operates kind of that way. It goes out for a long time.
Yes, we have several credits.
Yes.
Where the sunset is on the time at which you can start the account.
Correct.
Or
that
the
is
action.
How this is.
Right.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. Anybody, any other questions for the panel? Thank you. Representative Smith Warner, I think we have our instructions. The -12.
Mr. Chair, I move the -A-12 amendment to House Bill 4007.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves the -A-12 amendment to House Bill 4007. Discussion? Any objection to the motion? You want to leave the fee where it is now?
Yeah.
Okay. You'd rather have the higher fee. All right, we better call the roll. Now, the question is on adoption of the A-12 amendment, which changes the fee from $75 to $60, and which extends the date 2 years.
Chair Barnhart,
yes.
Do you mind if we just take
let's take a short at ease. Don't go away. committee will come back to order, please. Thank you very much. When we took our at ease, we were on a work session on House Bill 4007, and the motion on the before the committee was the adoption of the Dash 12 amendment. All right, and we were about to vote. And is there any further discussion? Okay. Is there any objection to the motion? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So really quick, so Republicans are going to vote in favor of reducing the fee down to the $60, but we still stand of the opinion that additional discussion needs to be had. We need to see the Dash 13 amendments and allow leadership from both caucuses to communicate a little further on this issue.
Thank you. And of course, because the bill is going to go to Ways and Means, you'll have that opportunity.
I think we have multiple opportunities.
And of course, because of your particular committee assignments, you get to do it again anyway.
I think I've got three or four times touching this bill.
Yeah, right. All right. So we better call the roll. Let me ask, is there objection to the Dash 12? It sounded like maybe there isn't anymore. All right, so the Dash 12 is adopted. Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4007 as amended to the floor with a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
All right, I'm going to rephrase that, and you tell me if I have it right.
All right.
Representative Smith-Warner moves House Bill 4007 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Have I got it right?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
You both said it the same way.
Well, not quite. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would share with this committee that while we're all still trying to form consensus on House Bill 4007, there is an outlying issue within the Oregon Department of Revenue. Right now, there's your General Government Subcommittee on Ways and Means is working with that department to make sure that the workload they have they can manage at an optimum level. And so I would hope the Department of Revenue would take note of that as we add additional responsibilities potentially onto them, that they'd be prepared to share with Ways and Means how they're going to handle these additional responsibilities. Thank you.
Consider yourselves warned. All right, thank you. Any other discussion? Representative Finley, please.
Thank you, Chair Barr. The only question I have or comment is if we have more amendments coming, I guess I'm selfish enough that I think we as a committee ought to hear them before we pass it on.
Mm-hmm.
If it affects this committee, we should see all the information before we push it out. But that's just my belief. So.
And let me just comment on that. If we were in a long session and we had another month to go, I'd completely agree with you about that. But I think under the circumstances, the changes we're talking about are the kind of changes that we can expect staff to bird dog, the LRO staff to bird dog, and the Ways and Means Committee to adopt. They have no more interest than we do in giving away tax dollars for no reason.
Thank you.
But otherwise, I would completely agree with your point if we weren't in a time crunch. Yeah. Any other discussion? Okay, so the motion is on a motion that essentially refers the bill to the Committee on Ways and Means. Let's call the roll.
Representative Mueller?
No.
Representative Findlay?
No.
Representative Hernandez?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Reschke?
Nay.
Vice Chair Smith Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Not yet.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. Motion carries, and the bill goes to the Committee on Ways and Means. We'll close the work session on House Bill 4007 and open a work session on House Bill 4139. Colleagues, while she's coming up, I'll remind you this is the bill that changes the way in which we tax the value of mobile equipment in some instances. And you might want to give us a greater summary than that. And I think there's some amendments too, aren't there?
There is an amendment. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4139 is a bill that imposes a 2%
tax on the rental price of heavy equipment to be collected at the time of rental. And there is currently property tax on heavy equipment assessed at the location on January 1st of each year. And this would change the tax to an excise tax. And the intent of the bill is to be a net revenue neutral bill. So there will be a parallel system that the Department of Revenue will conduct to compare the rental, the tax revenue that would have been collected under current law with the tax revenue that's collected under this bill if it becomes law. And then if there's a deficit, there's additional monies that will be owed by the companies that rent the equipment. And if there is a surplus, it will be refunded. And the Department of Revenue will collect up to 5% of the total amount from that gross amount. And there was an issue discussed last time about around areas and counties that currently currently receive monies from or benefits from this program, but then because they don't have tax or because they don't have rental facilities in that location under this new law, that they might be disadvantaged in some way. And so the amendment, the dash one, takes the 2% of gross receipts and redistributes that to the counties on a pro rata basis. And I am unclear at this moment whether pro rata is proportional to the distribution that they would have received, or it's it means proportional, but if it's an equivalent basis. Or
well, the language specifically says that it's the counties that don't receive any money under the normal rule.
Right.
So the first thing you have to do is you subtract all the counties that are going to get money under the normal rule, and then the 2% gets distributed to the others. What does pro rata mean, Representative Smith, in this case?
I do not know, but let me share this with you. My thought is on the dash one amendments. I think 2% of the gross money serves as a very adequate starting point, and should over a period of time, should those counties who feel that 2% is not enough or excessive, that percentage can be adjusted in the future. But I think for purposes of assisting those counties who do not have facilities located within their geographical boundaries, I think this is a very fair start.
Thank you. Would you make a note that when this goes to Ways and Means, we need to define pro rata?
You bet.
Yes, or change it to a different language?
You bet.
Because I don't think it works. But I think your point, I think what you want to do is clear.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that the counties that currently get a little bit under the current rule will continue to get a little bit under the new rule.
And I would share with you, Mr. Chair, in Morrow County, that's experienced excessive industrial growth. Much of this type of equipment flows into the county, but we do not have anyone who rents it. And
there's no rental office there.
There isn't a rental office. That only works out to about $14,000 a year.
It's not
a,
yeah.
And so it's not a game changer. I think it's more about just.
Does the department want to be heard?
Sure.
Please come.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. We also looked at the pro rata language, and it doesn't say pro rata based off of a certain factor. If it said pro rata based off a population, we would know exactly how to distribute it. Given that it doesn't modify anything else, we would assume that it is based off of the number of counties that meet that criteria. That is, they do not have a rental facility, and so we would distribute it equally among the counties that don't have a rental facility.
And that might work.
Works for me.
It might work.
Or land mass.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Garst? Thank you. Thank you very much. All right. This bill goes to Ways and Means by prior reference, doesn't it? Yeah. Representative Smith, do you have a motion for us?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash one amendments to House Bill 4139.
Representative Smith moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 4139. Is there a discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. I should have asked, we have the paperwork that we need to get the bill to Ways and Means. I'm getting a head nod. Okay. All right. Representative Smith?
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 4139 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a prior reference to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. That's good enough. Thank you. Representative Smith moves House Bill 4139 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? I don't see any. Motion carries. Bill goes to Ways and Means. We close the work session on House Bill 4139. Colleagues, we're going to hold over till, I guess our next meeting is Monday, isn't it? To Monday for House Bill 4080. And open a work session on House Bill 4028. Please. Tell us where we are on this bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon once again. House Bill 4028, as a reminder, this is a tax credit bill that has a number of tax credits combined into it. We have the Dash 7 amendment, which was actually a combination of the Dash 1, 4, and 5. So that's the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit, the Film and Video, and then the Manure Processor and Collector. So that's in the Dash 7. That has remained unchanged now for better part of a week or so. But we've got that combined as one amendment. We do have the revenue and the fiscal impact. The revenue for the Dash 7 for all three of those is minimal, and the fiscal is a no impact for the Dash 7. The Dash 11 is amending and making changes to the Working Family Household Dependent Care Credit. So again, the committee heard a little bit about this yesterday. Just as a refresher, the way the credit works is it's almost two parts where you have the expenses, and these are generally going to be child care expenses, mm-hmm. and then you apply a credit percentage against those. And the main change in the Dash 11 has to do with aiding students, whether they're primarily it's for single filer students, but also joint filer students, giving them the ability to claim the credit when they're of lower mm-hmm. income. And that works through... it allows this imputed income, because the credit, right now there's limitations on the expenses related to a taxpayer's income, and then also the actual expenses, and there's hard caps of 12 and 24,000, whether you have one child or two children. So what the bill will do with the imputed income, if you're a student, it will allow you to use that imputed income to help determine your expenses. Now, of course, that'll be still limited by those 12 or 24,000 hard caps or your actual expenses. That's a key thing I may have glossed over previously, is if your actual child care expenses are $8,000 a year, your credit percentage would apply against the actual expenses. But so it would help eliminate or in some ways move up that limit related to income. And then the second part is for those students that are under 110% of federal poverty level, their AGI is a percentage of federal poverty level, mm-hmm. it'll yeah. ensure yeah. they get the highest percentage based on the age of the child, the youngest child.
Are you okay?
So those are the main changes in the bill and the mechanics of it.
All right. Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Chair. Kyle, I have a question that looks like on the first page. I don't know if this was in a prior amendment, but I'm just not seeing it. In the Dash 11, the inclusion of the phrase as a degree-seeking student. And I'm just wondering if that eliminates people who are in certificate programs or doing other kinds of work training kinds of things that we would certainly see as being appropriate for this.
Yes, Representative Marsh, the degree-seeking student, in a way that was added, especially for the part-time students, where there was some concern if you were taking just picking up one course or something to that effect. So it is declared that you are a fully enrolled and degree seeking. So that's something the student would declare at the time of the school when they become enrolled. And it would be for, I believe it would be at the University a bachelor's or also an associate's degree. Certificates, I think, would probably, dependent upon how exactly it's administered, probably wouldn't make the cut there.
So
Please, yep.
So if you're in cosmetology school, you don't get to go, you don't get the tax credit.
That might be a question for the panel that we just called up. I don't know. Do any of you want to tackle that question? I know you're here for a slightly different reason, I suspect.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. We actually are here for that, although I'm not sure I can answer that question. I just wanted to start with an overview, tying it back to the work that we did in 2015.
Can we do that, Representative Marsh, and then we'll get back to your question.
Just a couple minutes, because you started getting into the weeds, and I wanted to just give the high-level picture. In 2015, you passed House Bill, we all passed House Bill 2171, and part of that, and I got the great pleasure of working with Chris Allenack a lot, many, many, many work groups. Representative Bueller was on that work group. And we were trying to make more efficient because it was coming up for renewal, the child care tax credit, the working family child care tax credit, and the child independent tax care credit. So we had two different credits. There was a huge overlap of about 24,000 out of 25,000 people actually claimed both. We were trying to make it more efficient. We wanted to make sure that it was refundable as the working family tax credit was, but we wanted to tie it as closely as possible to the federal so that the people who were claiming that on the federal wouldn't have to be audited. There were a whole number of things that we did, and you may remember we went into great detail. As they have rolled this out, they have flagged several inconsistencies between state and federal law that need to be addressed in order to properly implement this combined credit. So one is clarifying Oregon residents who earn out-of-state income and yet file Oregon taxes can still claim the credit. Another is changing the applicable date to January 1st, 2018 to conform to and correct changes made in Senate Bill 162 that came in 2017. And this last one is an issue of equity for students. So this is something that I think in all the discussions we had, we didn't go into enough. But basically, because it's tied, this portion is tied to the federal child independent tax credit, we do not give as much help as we should be giving to full-time married students and to full and part-time unmarried students because we don't impute any income for the fact that they're out there studying. So in other words, they're going to school, they're making very little income, maybe $2,000, and so they're only eligible for up to $2,000 of expenses, even though the tax credit allows you up to $12,000 in expenses for one dependent and $24,000 for two or more. But because we're not valuing the time that they're actually in class and they're not making income, they're held down by that low income. And in fact, part-time married students are excluded entirely because the thought is, oh, they're married, they have a spouse who's working, and so somebody can pay for childcare. So the idea, the policy question before you that I would raise is if we want to help students be able to go to school and be able to afford childcare while they're in school, which is a very, you know, strong economic development pathway for people to get to a higher level. We don't want them to get stuck in poverty. We want them to continue in education. And we know childcare is very expensive. We need to make sure that we include them in this tax credit. And so I used to work with Chris Allenack on these issues. I've had the great pleasure of now working with Kyle and Deanna Mack and stakeholders who have sat through several hours of how would we do this, and I'll let them talk about how we got to the imputed, and I know that Kyle can also answer a lot of the questions about how, if this is the policy option that we would adopt, how would we do that?
Very good. Thank you.
My name is Alicia Temple, and I work at the Oregon Law Center. Chair Barnhart and the committee. I don't need to add much to what the representative said, but we'll just say that this is something that was very new to me as of 2 weeks ago. And as we have dove into it, it is clear that the gaps that are in current law were unintentional in the process in the last couple of sessions of making these policy changes. And the most logical way that we came up with as a group to solve that was to both continue to tie it to federal law where we were for other groups, but then raising it to the Oregon caps that we also had raised for these other groups to ensure that for all categories of students, married, single, part-time, full-time, we are creating the same opportunities for accessing this credit. We know that our low-income students who have children, it's a really important time to be providing this support to them. It creates them, they're already, you know, trying to be on a path out of poverty, and this allows them to really invest in that time for themselves and their family, and it's in line with what this credit was originally intended to do. I will just quickly to Representative Marsh's question. I think a really good question, and something we had as well as the definition of student changed in different amendments. My understanding is that the previous definition as it was still made it tricky to be a part-time student. The federal definition in statute is full-time student, and so this was a way to try to broaden it to include part-time, but I think that's something that still needs to be considered.
Thank you.
And this is Kate Newhall, for the record, with Family Forward. And I really feel like everything that needs to be said has been said. And I guess I'll just end with a ditto on all of those pieces. And I think one of the things that really, I guess, popped out to me through this is really, in working on this, is wanting to make sure that we were being equitable between all of the students, whether you're married, whether you're unmarried, whether you're part-time, whether you're full-time, that this should be something that you should be able to claim. And I think, to Alicia's point, does really help people in their career trajectory if they're able to stay in school and get that degree, whatever that degree might be. So thank you.
Very good. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Kyle. Kyle, I'm looking at the revenue impact of the Dash 11s. I want to make sure I'm really clear. So for this fiscal year, it'd be a $2.8 million impact on the general fund. Is that of this amendment or of all legislation relating to the Working Family Household Independent Care Tax Credit?
Representative Smith, that's just to the amendments. That's the additional amount. The underlying estimated impact right now, I believe the last one that came out in the governor's tax expenditure report was around $60 million per biennium for the existing.
And just so the public understands that, that's been passed in previous sessions. This is just a modification to that credit.
Yes.
Did you say 1.6 or 6.0?
6.0.
Thank you.
So just one quick
please
comment. I want to point out again to the committee, because the Department of Revenue will end up playing a role in this, keep in mind once again, this is an entity that is understaffed and is working through multiple management issues. And we collectively as a body need to understand this is going to put additional pressure on that department as they try to figure out both their new computer system and staffing issues. So I just want to make sure everyone understands that's an outlying issue for all of us.
Thank you.
The Ways and Means guy in me.
Well, you know, it's useful to have you on this committee because of those comments now and then on things that we need to pay attention to.
Can I just add on that?
Please. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair, for that comment. And again, Deanna has been really helpful in coming up with definitions that would make it easier to implement.
Yep. As long as we're asking that kind of question, degree-seeking student, do we know what those words mean? Oh, Deanna's going to answer that for us.
Get out of the way for the expert here.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And my understanding of the reason for that particular term, Representative Marsh, is that it ties to financial aid. It's a federal term that ties to financial aid, and it is a term that goes towards anybody who is seeking a certificate, a degree program that transfers to a university that that accepts or issues a degree or an advanced degree. So certificates would qualify.
Would or would not?
Would, under my understanding of what the degree-seeking student means as far as financial aid goes. If they're a non-degree-seeking student, if they're just taking a fun class because they want to learn how to do pottery or something, then it wouldn't qualify.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doesn't that kind of stink for students who are in apprenticeship programs and having to take classes in apprenticeship but aren't going to receive a degree?
Ah, but they get paid during the day.
You get paid when you're in an apprenticeship program.
Even the first years do?
Oh, yes.
Well,
never mind that question.
Yeah.
But they still need childcare.
They still need childcare. There you go.
Apprenticeship is a great deal, but of course they have income, which can use to qualify them for this.
That's right.
They don't need this imputed credit that we're talking about in this bill. I'm getting head nods. They agree with me.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I think apprenticeship programs are the best kept secret around because you can earn money and go to school at the same time. I want to make certain I understand this. This thing is set up so that it complies with the Internal Revenue Code's rules around this set of topics.
Mr. Chair, it is based largely on IRC Section 2021.
As it says in the current law.
Correct. And where those differences are, we came forward and pointed out those differences related to these student situations, which ended up with these policy conversations.
Yeah.
Largely IRC Section 21, but for the cap, the $12,000 and $24,000 cap.
Okay. And does this bill affect what the students could get under these at the federal level?
Mr. Chair, it does not. This is an Oregon-only credit.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I feel comfortable giving you motions if you're ready.
Yeah. Yes, please. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
-7 and -11.
Yep. So, Mr. Chair, I move the -7 amendments to House Bill 4028.
Representative Smith moves the amendments to -7 to 4028. Representative Kenny Geyer, you may want to stick around for just another minute. All right. Is there further discussion on the -7 amendment? I don't see any objection to the -7. All right, -7 is adopted.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move the -11 amendments to House Bill 4028.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves the -11 amendment to House Bill 2048. Further discussion? Any objection to that motion? Representative Rushkey?
Yeah, just an objection.
Oh, okay, we'll call the roll on the -11 amendment. The motion is whether or not the -11 amendment becomes a part of the bill.
And I want to be clear, I heard you say 2028, but it's 4028.
I'm sorry, I keep doing that, yeah. Don't I? It is 4028. If I say 20 anything, it means 40.
Okay.
All right, thank you. I appreciate the correction. I want the minutes to reflect what we're actually doing and not something else. Please, call the roll.
Representative Bueller.
Yes.
Representative Findley.
Yes.
Representative Fernandez.
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Reschke?
Nay.
Vice Chair Smith Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Smith?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4028 as amended. Does this have a reference to Ways and Means?
No.
No, it's going straight to the floor.
It's to the floor, yeah.
To the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves House Bill 4028 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now we have more discussion. Representative Rushkey, do you want to be heard?
No.
No? Any objections to the motion? All right, so the bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The only significantly complex part of this bill is the -11 amendment. I'm wondering if I can prevail on Representative Kenny Geyer to carry the bill. That's why I wanted you to stay. Representative Kenny Geyer will carry. And if you need help on other portions of the bill, if you need help on other parts of the bill, some of us will stand up and answer them, or we'll coach you ahead of time. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4028. And
is there a bow bunch in there as well?
Have I dealt with everything I need to deal with? So we can adjourn. We'll meet on Monday. Have a great rest of the week and the weekend. Committee's adjourned.
Representative Marsh.